Psalm 95. Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come to into his presence with thanksgiving. Let us make a joyful noise to him with songs of praise. For the Lord is a great God, a great King above all gods. In his hand are the depths of the earth, and the heights of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God, and we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, as at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. For 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. Therefore I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Shall we look to God in prayer? Lord, we come to you this morning and we ask you, God, that you will minister to us. Lord, our hope is not in anything else, O God. It is purely in your word and in what the Spirit of the Lord can do in our midst this morning. And so we come to you and we ask you, God, that you will help us, that you will open our eyes to see you through your word, O God, and that we might truly, appropriately respond to you. Please, Lord, come and have your way in our midst. We ask these for Christ's sake. Amen. Now, Psalm 95 is the second of a series of psalms that praise God as a king. And the other psalms, you know, they begin from verse chapter 93 all the way through chapter 99. And this is a psalm, one of those psalms where the praise is exclusively for God as a king, and they celebrate the fact that he's not just the king, he's also the creator and also the shepherd of his people. So this is usually recited as a liturgy, while the liturgical actions were taking place as a part of the worship in the temple and later on during the in the synagogues in the later part when they were, you know, there was no temple available and so on and so forth. But this psalm can be divided into three parts, my friends. Number one, you find here that there is a call to worship. There is a call to worship, number one. Number two, there is the cause for worship. And number three, you'll also find the characteristics of authentic worship. And we're going to look at it one after the other. Number one, the call to worship. The call to worship. The word come in this psalm appears three times. It appears in verse 1, it appears in verse 2, it also appears in verse 6. Of course, in the original language, all those words are slightly different, but have the same sort of meaning or connotation. In verse 1, when the psalmist is saying, oh, come, the word actually means move, walk, start walking, because it was part of the procession where they were moving towards the temple. So that's the first part. And verse 2, the come here actually means come to meet, come to encounter. Because they are getting closer, the procession is at the outer courts. And the third come, you find it in verse 6, where the psalmist says, "Oh, come, let us worship and bow down." It's more of a, it has this intimate touch to it. It's like calling to enter through the door and asking, you know, the congregants to come, enter into the place of worship. Irrespective of what these nuances are of this word, the truth of the matter is, it is clearly a call to worship. The community is summoned to worship. And this call, I believe, is also for each one of us, my friends. The call is to worship God, because to worship God is our ultimate call. Because we were created for worship. We were created to worship God. Isaiah chapter 43 and verse 7, it says, we were formed for His glory. We were created to glorify God. In Revelation chapter 4 and verse 11, we were created for His good pleasure. We don't have to be students of anthropology to understand that we were created to worship, because everyone, everywhere is worshiping something or the other, be it somebody who is living in the middle of the most urban setting, or someone, you know, a tribal person who's living in an obscure island. Everybody is worshiping something or the other, from animism to materialism and everything in between. That's a clue for us to understand that there is this innate desire in each one of us to worship. That's why Westminster's Catechism, you know, says the chief end of man is to glorify Him, glorify and enjoy Him forever. And John Piper tweets it a little bit and he says, glorify while enjoying Him. Now, we're not just created to worship, but we were recreated to worship. In other words, we were made to be born again in Christ. Through His death and His resurrection, we were made to be born again. In that sense, we were recreated so that He could make, turn rebels into worshipers of God, because we never truly worshipped God before that. So this is the call, my friends, to worship Him. The call is to worship Him. We were created to worship Him. We were recreated to worship Him. And also the goal of church is to worship. The ultimate goal of the church is not missions. The ultimate goal of the church is worship. Years ago, I read this book by John Piper. It's called Let the Nations Be Glad, The Supremacy of God in Missions. And he says, missions is not the ultimate goal of the church. Worship is. Missions exist because worship doesn't. Because there are people who are not worshiping the true and living God. That's why we do missions. There will come a day where missions will end. But worship will continue forever and ever and ever, because that is going to be our chief preoccupation. The chief preoccupation of all creatures in heaven is worship. And I think we must learn to do it well here on earth. I think it was Erwin Lutzer, a pastor of Moody Church, for a long time, he said something like this. He said, if we haven't learned to be worshipers, it doesn't really matter how else we do anything else. We are supposed to be worshipers even before we can be workers for God. Doesn't really matter what else we can do. Because to worship God is our greatest call, is our ultimate call. And God calls us to worship Him. And He calls the world through us to worship Him. in worshiping him, because in worshiping him, it's not just the most appropriate, worthy response to this worthy God, but this is also good for us, because in worshiping him, we find our greatest joy. In worshiping him, we find our highest pleasure. In worshiping him, we find our deepest satisfaction, my friends. And somehow, you know, we're constantly chasing other things and treasure other things, you know, in our pursuit of, you know, finding satisfaction. But the answer lies in this, that we must look to him and focus on him, because in worshiping him, you know, we do good to ourselves. So number one, there's a call to worship. Number two, we also find the cause for worship in this passage. There's a cause to worship, cause for worship. The object of all biblical worship is God, my friends. Look into the Bible, into that passage. Look at it, in verse 1, it says, "Oh, come, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise to the rock of our salvation. Let us come into his presence." Some translations say, "Let us come before his face." Let us come before him. Let us make a joyful noise to him. Let us come, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before him. Worship is not something that can be manufactured by lights and smoke and great music, my friends. Worship is always a response to the worth of God, and for that we must encounter him. For that we must come before him, because worship is always a response. We cannot try to manufacture it by ourselves. We can never try to do that. Does it happen here in Canada? But in India, this happens so much that when there's a popular worship band comes, suddenly everybody is worshiping. When somebody who's not really as famous as them and normal guy is leading worship, people are looking here, there, and like, okay, when is this going to end? Because somehow we have made the other things that are supposed to aid us in worshiping God become the objects of our worship. It doesn't really matter, my friends. God is central. God is the center, the object of all Christian worship. And the call here of worship, call to worship here, is because of the cause of our worship, who is most certainly God. But in this passage, more specifically, two aspects of God, according to this psalm: his greatness and his goodness, his universal kingship and his covenantal relationship. Where do I get that? Look at verse 3 to 5 and verse 7. His universal kingship, you find that in verse 3 to 5. And his covenantal relationship, he's not just a great God out there, but he's also a God, he's a shepherd to his people. Covenantal relationship. Let's kind of look into it a little deeper. Verse 3, let's look at verse 3. "For the Lord is a great God, a great king above all gods. In his hands are the depths of the earth. The heights of the mountains are his. The sea is his, for he made it, and his hands formed the dry land. In whose hands are the depths of the earth?" There was this popular belief in the ancient Near East culture that, you know, the depths of the earth belong to some other powers. But the psalmist is saying, no, 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 it belongs to God. The peaks of the mountains, they believed that on the highest mountains was the abode of gods. And the psalmist is reminding, listen, it belongs to God. In a simpler sense, psalmist is saying, he also could be saying, nobody can measure the depths of the earth, but it is in the hands of the Lord. The highest mountains, whose glimpse, just a glimpse of it, can cause us to stagger, are the works of his hand. He not only created them, but he controls all things from the deepest point of the earth to the most exalted mountains and everything in between. He is Lord. He is the King. He is the ruler, my friends. But you know what? His absolute sovereignty is not just in the vertical dimension, from the peaks to the depths. The passage also says, the sea is his. The horizontal dimension, the width of everything in this universe belongs to God. The seas are his. And his hands form the dry land. It reminds us of the third day of creation as he pulled the seas to allow the land to appear. And then he marks out the boundaries for them according to Proverbs chapter 8, verse 29. He marks the boundaries for them and says, you don't cross these, and they don't. Our God is infinitely great, my friends. And he is preeminent over all the other so-called gods of the world. And there is no equal to him. There is no peer. We all have peers, right? But there is, for this God, there is no rival, there is no equal, there is no peer. There is no one, you know, before God where God can say, you know, I am like him or that thing or that. He's unique in himself. There's no one like him. And that's why the Lord alone is great. He's great King above all gods. I began to think, you know, why is God alone great? Because I believe that God alone has intrinsic worth. You know what the word intrinsic means? Value in himself. You know, for everything in this creation, in this universe, we get our worth from something else, isn't it? But for God, his worth is in himself. Nothing gives him worth. Not even our worship, my friends. We worship him because he deserves. We don't give, you know, worth to him. It's just that something that we ascribe to him as a response to his worth. It's not just intrinsic in his worth. His infinite worth. There is no, he cannot be limited. In terms of time, he is eternal. He was always there. He will always be there. From everlasting to everlasting, the psalmist says, you are God. The mountains appear, they will disappear. But you, O God, will be there forever. In terms of time, he is eternal. In terms of space, he is omnipresent. In terms of knowledge, he is omniscient. In terms of power, he is not just powerful, he is all powerful, omnipotent. And his worth is also incomparable, my friends. Who will you compare this God to? In Exodus chapter 15, verse 11, says, who among the gods is like you, Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders? Who, Lord, is like you? Are you going to compare him to the lords of the earth, like the kings and the rulers and the powers? This is what Isaiah says in verse 23 of chapter 40. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Will we compare him to the nations? Verse 15 of Isaiah 40 says, surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales. He weighs the islands as though they are fine dust. Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. Before him, all the nations are as nothing. They are regarded as worthless, less than nothing. What else will we compare this God to? some treasure on this earth? The same chapter says, it is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. He stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. We can't compare. Will we compare him to something in heaven? The elders laid their crowns and fall on their faces and worship. And even the closest creatures to the very presence of God cannot even dare to look at this God. Who will you compare this God to? He alone is the king above all gods. Even today, my friends, even in this world. Over the gods that we probably may have made for ourselves, even as we sit here. The gods of possessions, the gods of positions, the gods of, you know, powers, the gods of, like, you know, there are times people can be our gods, and gods of pleasures. I was passing through a little street in India, and I saw this. I was passing through a retreat center, actually, and there was this huge hoarding outside. There was a seminar that was being conducted. And you know what the name of the seminar was? The Art of Worshipping Yourself. The Art of Worshipping Yourself. Today, my friends, we have become our own gods. There are philosophies that teach us that you are God. You just have to realize that. But the truth of the matter is, there is only one God. There's only one great God. And we must all come and submit before him. He's not just described as this universal king. He's also, the psalmist reminds his readers about the Lord's covenantal relationship. It's not just his kingship. Look at verse 6. It says, "Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for he is our God. We are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand." Look at the progression. The Lord is not a great God out there, but he is our Maker. He's not just the creator of the world, but he's our Maker. He's our Shepherd. And we are the people of his pasture, the sheep of his hand. And in his goodness and in his grace, he provides, he protects, he guides as a shepherd does for his sheep. But then he doesn't stop there. He is not just a shepherd, he's a good shepherd who lays down his life for his people. And that's what we see in John chapter 10, verse 11 to 14. We see Jesus, the Lord, from whom, through whom, for whom all things are created, is also this good shepherd who in his mercy and grace laid down his life to rescue us from our sin and the penalty of sin. And that's why, you know, in heaven, when you read through the pages of Revelation, you find the glimpses of, you know, worship in heaven. And you know who is the center of all worship? The Lamb that was slain is a center of worship, because he alone is worthy, worthy. So the Lord is a reason for our worship. We are called to worship, number one, and the reasons that are given are his universal kingship and his covenantal relationship through Jesus Christ. But the third thing that we need to ask is, now, how do we respond to this truth about God? How do we respond? Does the psalmist prescribe anything or at least describe it in this passage. Before we go there, you know, I want to reiterate this, that worship is always a response to the revealed truth about God. Like I said, it is not something that we can manufacture. It's always in response to the truth that has been revealed to us in His Word. It's not just the God of our imagination that we suddenly start worshiping. It is as a response to the truth that we see, and then we respond. Because the word worship, you know, is an Anglo-Saxon word which actually comes from the word worth-ship, which means to see the worth and then respond to the worth. You see the worth and then you respond to the worth. So you cannot simply respond without seeing the truth about God. To be a worshiper, you don't have to go to a worship school. To be a worshiper, you need to know God, the truth about God. The more, you know, you begin to see the truth about who He is, the more instinctive worship will become. Where you don't want to even look up, you want to fall on your face and worship because of the worth of God. Let's move on to the third one. So how do we respond? What are the characteristics of authentic worship? What are the characteristics of authentic worship from this passage? Number one, I find it interesting that this psalm, you know, calls for the community to worship. The first thing that I have seen in this passage is one of the characteristics of authentic worship is that it is congregational. Look at it. Oh, come, let us sing. Let us come into His presence. Let us make a joyful noise. But you know what? To be able to worship congregationally, one must learn to worship Him personally. Otherwise, we are only pretending here. If we have not known what it means to worship God personally, then we are only doing it to just go through the motions, nothing else. But the great value of congregational worship is that it continues to shape our understanding of God, which in turn impacts the depth of our worship. Tim Keller says this. He says, you will never know all the facets of God until you are worshiping in a community, because none of us know God as well as all of us put together. Yes or no? And that's why we need to come and we need to hear one another when we worship, because when we do that, we are also being edified. The more we are edified, the more we worship God. It's not just congregational, but look at it. It's a fascinating psalm. It's not just congregational. Number two, it is vocal, very, very vocal. Can you read the psalm and you can't just say that they were just silently meditating or anything like that? It says, let us sing to the Lord. Let us make a joyful noise. Did I read it right? Make a joyful noise. Let us come before His presence. Let us make a joyful noise. Just in case you didn't get it the first time, you know, the psalmist is saying, you know, a joyful noise to the Lord. He talks about singing. He talks about shouting. He talks about joyful noise. In fact, the word there, commentators say that in English text, These verses are actually too tame. The psalmist actually calls upon his hearers to shout, to sing aloud. The words that are used there actually mean like a war cry. A cry of alarm. A praise that sounds so intense as a war cry, using all force and all power that the human body has.
I don't think it's like, here I'm to worship, and then look at somebody, here I'm to worship. No, no, no. It's more than that, my friends. It's vocal. It's expressing, you know, this great, you know, your gratitude or whatever it is, but you're expressing that in praise before God. It's quite vocal. It's not just vocal, but it's also emotional. There are emotions here. Can you find some emotions there? It says joyful noise. It says shout joyfully. There are affections that are attached. There are emotions that are attached. Worship is no doubt, like I said, is a response to the truth about God, but it cannot be a cold response to God. Truth about God must thrill us and delight us more than the thrills and the delights that we express for anything else, my friends. I heard about Niagara Falls all of my life. And then finally, in July, I landed in Canada. And I think in August, it's this ritual for all the, you know, people here. The minute they come to Canada, at least in our family, they take them to Niagara Falls. And I went there. My jaw dropped. I was like, wow. You express, right? We express in all other things. We express in relationships. You know, you're singing a song to your wife. You're not going to sing it emotionlessly because she will find out and she'll say, you're lying. No, you're looking at my wife. Now, you go to a game watching Raptors and something amazing happens there. You just burst out in joy or whatever. I remember in 2011, when India won the World Cup, my jaw knew no bounds. And some of you are sighing and you're like, okay, you had the opposite emotion because it was against Sri Lanka. But then what I'm trying to say is in everything when you celebrate or express, you use emotions. Even when we express that before God, emotions are involved. Yes, we know, we must be aware of the dangers of emotionalism in the church, where it is all emotions and no basis on the truth. But then we don't throw the baby with the bathwater. Emotions are important, my friend. And then we should be able to express that with all of our hearts. Because when you read the psalm, you know, you don't get any other impression but this. Because he constantly saying, whether it is to himself or the others, the psalmist is saying, bless the Lord, O my soul, all that is within me. It is not half-hearted. It's all that is within me. It's full of your heart. Someone said, doxology that does not spring from good theology is idolatry, which is true. But the other thing is also true, that good theology that does not lead to doxology is dead orthodoxy, my friends. Yes, we must be rooted in good theology, but that must be translated to doxology or worship that is from your heart. Because we are called to worship God in spirit and in truth, not one or the other. We are called to worship God in spirit and in truth. But the great thing about this passage is it's so
well balanced. It's not just emotions that are there. It's not just emotional in one sense. But when you look at verse 6, there is the reverential aspect in worship. Let us worship and bow down and let us kneel. These three words. The word worship is actually there, is prostrate yourself. The psalmist is saying the same thing. You prostrate yourself. You bow down. You kneel. Because all these postures are associated with reverence. And this is the only proper response to this one supreme king of the universe, my friends. That we come and rever before him. That we reverence him. So it is not just some sort of out of control kind of craziness, but we rever this God and we give our praise and worship to him through that. We come before him and we bend our knee before him. And when we bend our knee before him, we are saying, God, I am not God, you are God. It's not just reverential, it is also volitional. In other words, will. It's something to do with your will. How can you bend your knee without first bending your will, my friends? Because you cannot truly ever worship God without offering your will to God in surrender. Not just that. The final part of it is we worship God with a loyal life. Look at verse 8 onwards. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on the day at Massah in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test and put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. They saw God. They saw the works of God. They saw the goodness of God. And yet they did not respond with loyalty. They did not respond with loyalty. In fact, in Meribah and Massah, those two words mean quarreling and testing, where they feared that they would not have adequate water in the wilderness, and they responded with faithlessness and hard-heartedness and rebelliousness, unwilling to trust God in the wilderness, in spite of witnessing the great deliverance of God. My friends, true worship ultimately is a lifestyle. Yet, yes, it is all this. But if your posture is bended, but in your life you don't obey God, then it means nothing at all. Because in 1 Samuel chapter 5 and verse 22, it says, obedience is better than sacrifice. Obedience is better than 10,000 songs that we can sing, my friend. Obedience is better than all the wonderful things that we can do for God as an act of worship to him. I think God calls us this morning to this, because this, I believe, is a heart of worship where we come and live a life of totally being loyal before God. And say, God, you are God, you are my Lord. I will do what you want and live with gratitude and faithfulness in our lives. Those guys, they were grumbling. They were complaining without trusting God. But God states this in the negative and he says, don't be like that. The psalmist is saying that don't be like that. If you truly want to worship God, then you must live a life that is loyal. Hear him. The words there actually means to obey. To obey. Obey him. Be grateful to him.
and keep trusting him. In Hebrews chapter 3, verse 7 to 11, I'll close with this. The same exact verse is quoted by the author of Hebrews. And you know what the context of that is? In the context of endurance of your faith. Worship is not just what we do with our, you know, voices and all that. But worship ultimately is a lifestyle where you pursue a life of faithfulness to God, where you pursue a life of trusting God in spite of things not working out for you. In spite of you being tempted to grumble and complain before God, you're looking at the worth and the works of God and say, no, I choose to continue to trust God because he is worthy of such a response. If you're here who's not, as a person who's not a follower of Jesus Christ, and you're wondering, what do I do? The same truth applies to each one of us, my friends. And the truth is this: this Jesus is the King of the universe, and yet he humbled himself. He came as a shepherd to die for his sheep. And he gave his life for you and for me, that we can be set free from our sin and the terrible wrath of God that is coming. So if you're not a follower of Jesus Christ, the verse is still relevant, and that is, do not harden your heart if you hear his voice. If you have been hearing this for a period of time, do not harden your heart. The only worthy response to God and what he's done for you on the cross is to bend your knee and say, God, I surrender my all to you this morning. If you're a follower of Jesus Christ, then you have to be able to continue to look at God, know his worth, and respond to his worth in the most appropriate way that will glorify and that will display his worth through your life and mine. Shall we close our eyes, look to God in prayer?